Welcome to In Context, the live edition of History Counts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with Gus Contavero. In today's program, we're going to discuss the reasons for the collapse of the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. And we'd like you listeners to give us your views by calling in during the program. We'll be giving out the phone number later. First, let's review some 9/11 facts. The World Trade Center's North Tower was struck by a Boeing 767 at 8:46 a.m. and completely collapsed less than 2 hours later. The South Tower was struck by another Boeing 767 at 9:03 a.m. and collapsed less than 1 hour later. 2,752 people died in the collapse of these two 110-story skyscrapers. Later that day, at 5:30 p.m., World Trade Center Building Number 7, which was 47 stories tall, also completely collapsed, though it had not been struck by a plane. In the years since 9/11, many scholars have examined the available scientific evidence of the collapse to understand why the Twin Towers and Building 7 fell down. Many of them, including over 1,000 members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, have concluded that the buildings did not collapse from the impact of the planes and subsequent fires, but rather, they collapsed as the result of a controlled demolition involving explosives placed inside the buildings. And they've called for a new 9/11 investigation. Gus, could you review why these architects, engineers, and other experts have come to the conclusion that there was a controlled demolition of the World Trade Center on 9/11?
Absolutely. There are some outstanding points that come across, and any one of these issues could be made to be, the ultimate issue that everyone should focus on. But put together, it's just an incredible body of evidence that makes it almost impossible to actually encapsulate the entire issue. We've got things like a vertical, symmetrical free fall that can be observed in dozens of videos. The many eyewitnesses who were there at the scene, firemen and policemen were there, the emergency workers, they all witnessed it, and it's indisputable. It fell straight down. The pulverization of the building material, which is not even one single pancaked 5-inch thick concrete and steel reinforced floor was left at the end. The official story was that it pancaked. Nothing was left intact. It was completely pulverized. There were squibs visible on the videos that appeared repeatedly coming laterally from the buildings just below the collapse line. So 40 to 60 feet below the progress of the collapse, you could see squibs that were coming out at 200 feet per second that preceded the collapse. And this is another thing that's indicative of a controlled demolition. Numerous witnesses, including firemen, heard several explosions. They saw flashes. And there's many interviews that are out there you can find on YouTube, on the internet, where they describe the explosions as pop, 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 as all the floors are collapsing one after another. And, that's another description of a controlled demolition where in succession, it's taking out those support beams one after another, pop, 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 pop. And it's with a rhythm. It's not random, like with a collapse of a structure, it's going to be random. It's not going to happen with symmetry because that's just not the way physics will work.
Sequentially.
Right. Some of the columns are going to hold a little longer than others, and some are going to be a little weaker than others, and it should fall sideways, not straight down, through the path of the most resistance. Pyroclastic clouds of concrete powder moving in all directions from buildings, and that's indicative, or it's you can only see that in two places. It's an active volcano explosion, or a collapsing building from explosion because of the way that it collapses and causes the debris to fly out. It creates what's called a pyroclastic cloud.
And it does look like a volcano in some of the pictures.
It does. At the top of it, the way it's just erupting with these mountains of clouds and they're streaming. What does Stephen Jones call them? The streamers, or Richard Gade calls them streams, where they're just like popping out. They're almost like cinders launching out from the top of it like it's a volcano. And if anyone's ever seen a volcano erupt, you'll know what I'm describing. The temperature of the fires was estimated at between 12 and 1600 degrees. We can tell that because of the color of the smoke. It was dark. It was oxygen starved. It was the building, the material that it was burning was paper. It was wood. It was, you know, building materials. It
so wasn't this is a typical hydrocarbon fire burning office
exactly.
furniture.
Exactly. Yeah. And the melting temperature of steel we know is 2750 degrees. That's not debatable. That's not something that you and I just made up. That is actually the scientific melting point of steel.
So there's over 1,000 degree Fahrenheit gap between the melting
exactly.
point of steel and the actual temperature of the fire.
That's right. And then we also know that the presence of molten steel in the ground for the weeks after collapse and was caught at the moments before the collapse on multiple video cameras where you can see moments before the collapse, there is streams of dripping molten steel coming out the corners of the buildings. And then for weeks after, it continued to burn and create these underground infernos that the firemen couldn't go down into because it was they described, quote, working in a foundry, unquote. And, you know, many of the official reporters, the people in the 9/11 Commission report, they would say they hadn't when they were questioned by independent journalists at their presentations, they said, I don't know what you're talking about. We never came across this material. But, you know, it was on television. It was on NBC. It was on CBS, on Fox. You know, why didn't they know?
One of the firemen said they doused it and doused it with water. They buried it in water, and it couldn't. They couldn't stop the fire.
We'll get to that, and there's a reason why the water didn't work. No precedent for a skyscraper to collapse due to fire. The Meridian Plaza. The Meridian Plaza.
And that was in Philadelphia in 1991.
Oh, yeah, 1991. That burned for 18 hours and didn't fall. There's also been a fire in Singapore, wasn't that right? And in China?
In China, recently.
There's been many. And there was also multiple fires in the World Trade Center itself that burned for many hours at hotter temperatures than what we thought the World Trade Center fires burned at, and that didn't cause collapse. And there's been no evidence that the structural integrity of the building was jeopardized by the plane impacts. And we have recordings of the people who helped to build the building, and they said that it was built to withstand planes larger and at a faster speed than the ones that struck. And they said that they suspected. What was the name of the fellow who was the building manager?
Frank.
He was the building manager for the World Trade Center. And he...
Frank DeMartini.
DeMartini. And he... was he the one who died on 9/11?
And he died it. Yeah, and he died it. And he... Well, back in 2006, we were fortunate enough to have Stephen Jones, who's probably the most important scientific researcher on the 9/11 movement. And... he related these points that Gus just listed in his discussion with us, and he said he was anxious to examine the residue of some of the debris mm-hmm. from the World Trade Center to see if he could confirm his thesis
right.
that the World Trade Center was destroyed in a controlled demolition using an incendiary called thermite. And subsequently, he got a sample of it, and he did test it, and he found very unusual elements which were characteristic of thermite, and fluorine and manganese. And they also indicated it was a particular type of thermite known as superthermite, which
right.
is applied in a gel. And then subsequent to his testing, there was further testing done with more advanced equipment, X-ray spectroscopes, by an international team of scientists. And in 2009, they published their findings, in which they reported that superthermite was found in four independently gathered samples of World Trade Center
And they
dust.
Were taken from places like an apartment whose windows were facing
That's
the World
right.
Trade Center. The
right.
dust swept in through the windows. Didn't her window blow out?
And the windows blew out. One of the ladies, she talks about it on TV, how she gathered her sample. Now, superthermite is a military incendiary developed at Lawrence Livermore Lab and other federally connected facilities in the
right.
1990s. It burns at 4,500 degrees, far higher temperature than is needed to melt steel. And in this form of superthermite, it's extremely effective. The superthermite is apparently reduced to a very small nanoparticles, and then immersed into a gelatin so that it can be applied with paste.
And the way that it works is it actually receives its oxygen from the steel itself when it literally dissects the steel and pulls out the iron from the steel. and burns off of the oxygen through that reaction, which is why when the firemen tried to douse water on the molten steel, it didn't have any effect.
You can't smother a superfine by fire. That's right.
And you can burn it underwater. It has no effect. Water doesn't have anything to do with it.
So that's a summary.
You have to suffocate. You have to take the oxygen out, which you can't do because it's burning on the fuel.
That's right. That's a summary of the reasons why so many scientists have come to the controlled demolition theory. We'd very much like to hear your views on the reason for the collapse of the World Trade Center and 9/11. So please give us a call here at WPKN at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And let the phone ring, because if we don't answer right away, it might mean that you're the next in line. So that's 203-336-9756. And if you just joined us, this is In Context with Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Canavero, and we're on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. And we're talking this evening about the collapse of the World Trade Center and the evidence that it may have been collapsed in a controlled demolition using pre-planted explosives. And we're taking phone calls at 203-336-9756.
Yeah, and there are so many issues around 9/11 that people, I think, sometimes get fatigued when they want to talk about these technical points. And do we have a call? Mm-hmm. All right, I want to bring them up. Hello, caller.
Yeah, I'm just curious to know the controlled demolitions that you're referring to. So who would be behind something like that?
We can speculate on who would have something to gain by it, who would have reasons to want to go to war, who would have reasons to want to demolish some of these buildings. But we're asking the questions as independent journalist citizens. We want to have a new investigation with subpoena power. I want to be able to ask people who I think might have a reason to do these things, why they would or would not have something to gain by it.
I'm just thinking, you know, to do such an event. I know you talked about it would only collapse. It would not collapse symmetrically, but even with a controlled, you're not going to get total symmetry there. But the main question I'm wondering is how, you know, if it was somebody from outside of the country, I don't know how it would be possible for them to coordinate such a thing. Uh-huh. So to me, it seems it would kind of rule out any kind of outside force. It would have to be like an inside thing, no?
So you think it would be difficult for example, Osama bin Laden to have gotten access to the building to pull this off?
Yeah, I'm saying, that's not something you could do overnight.
Absolutely not.
Well, there is one issue that's been raised, or aspect that has been raised, has to do with the elevators and whether someone would use the elevators to repair in order to get on.
Yeah, we know that they had there were elevator repairs going on with the months going on before 9/11, and that was an opportunity for someone to actually have access to those core columns.
Well, thank you very much for calling. We have another call.
Go ahead, caller.
You're on the air?
Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Are
yes, you're on the air, WPKN.
Okay. I just always looked at the photos, the movies of, it seemed like the building was collapsing from the top and each floor was caving in.
That's actually what you came away with?
Yeah, when you watch the actual footage of the buildings collapsing, it doesn't seem to collapse from the bottom. It seems to fold down one at a time from the top. Now,
that's a very good point. It doesn't necessarily, and they weren't quite uniform. There is a controlled demolition expert who addressed that in, I think it's the 9/11 movie done by Richard Gage, the head of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And he said that controlled demolitions don't have to be sequentially from the bottom. He said you could start at the middle, you could start at the top. He said what's key is that very quickly, though, you have to remove all of the supporting columns.
Well, one of the things about Towers 1 and 2, which is different than Tower 7, was that it was completely enshrouded in dust. We really couldn't see what was happening except for the evidence of the squibs that were coming out below the progress of the collapse, which would take out the path of most resistance, making it an easy freefall.
That is why a lot of the researchers focus on Building 7. Thanks very much, Carl. I believe we have another call. Hello, Carl. You're on the air at WPKN.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to talk about the people who might have had a motive. The first caller kind of asked, well, who would do such a thing as to, deliberately taking down the World Trade Centers with a controlled demolition, which it absolutely is. Anybody who's played a video in reverse in slow motion, or even in forward speed slow motion, which the mainstream media never, ever dared do. I have videos, and I've studied it very carefully, and there's absolutely, you can see the squibs that you referred to, which are a trademark in all large controlled demolitions. They are definitely there,
right.
Even in Building 7, the building that was not hit by a plane at all.
Exactly.
It fell at 5:30 in the evening on September the 11th, 2001. Back to the motive thing here. There was a document, a 76-page document, I think it was, called The Project for the New American Century.
I'm familiar with that.
Yes.
Yes, caller.
Yeah, it's a neoconservative think tank group, really.
Go ahead and tell us what that said.
Pardon?
Go ahead and tell us what that said.
Yeah, basically, another name for this Project for New American Century was also titled Rebuilding America's Defenses, where they stated that the goals of total U.S. military superiority would take a long time to achieve. And then this is the frightening sentence. Absent some catastrophic and cataclysmic event, like a Pearl Harbor event. And 1 year later to the day, they got their event, and we were in Afghanistan. In fact, the British were in Afghanistan 11 days before 9/11 with a major troop deployment. Not a lot of people know about that. And, of course, we were all set to go in to invade Iraq and control the oil resources. And the military bases that are there are built of huge mass concrete structures, not something out of tents with ditch latrines. These are super structures like the malls we go into. They have Wendy's, McDonald's, everything, every shop like you go in your local mall. Better bedding, I'm sure, is there. So these people have built these for 100 years at least. They're staying there. So this thing by Obama last night saying we're leaving, it's nonsense. I'm off subject there, I know, but that's
that group that you began with, the a group for the New American Century, that included Vice President Cheney and Richard Pearl and many other important people in the administration.
Yeah, I think one of the most important parts about 9/11 is actually talking about who can benefit from it, because it probably brings it home for people who just don't have the stomach to talk about the physics.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Do we have another call? Yeah, we have another call. Thanks a lot for calling.
Okay. Go ahead, caller.
You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, this is Jason, actually.
Hey, Jason. Thank you. Thanks for calling in, man.
Hi, Jason. It's Ken McDermott Rowe here with Gus.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Jason, I just want to introduce you really quick to the audience. You produced the film, or you directed the film, Fabled Enemies, Invisible Empire. You were producer on Loose Change. You've worked on detailing all the factual inaccuracies and misrepresentations by the press and government on the events of 9/11. You're an activist and a host, and you know quite extensively on a number of issues. You're involved with We Are Change Conference, and you're going to be speaking on Friday, September 10th, 2010. Is that correct?
That is correct. I'm going to be down in New York City for our Lives Post 9/11 conference with We Are Change New York City, and I'm looking forward to it.
That is awesome. One of the things that I see about the conference this year is that it is four days long. Thursday, Friday, it's 4 days long. It has dozens of great, knowledgeable guests who are extremely credible, not just, you know, a bunch of guys off the street just talking about what they think about happened, but, I mean, these are engineers, they're journalists, they're historians, they're PhDs. I mean, this is a really tremendous event that's going on.
Absolutely. Some of the names that I'm looking forward to meeting for the first time are people like Mike Gravel and George Galloway, and I think it's great. People like Richard Gage are going to be there, Ray McGovern, and also Cindy Sheehan, and just so many others. And, you know, this conference is now coming up on the heels of something that really just happened today, which I think is great. NIST lost their lawsuit today of an FOIA request of the 22,000-plus documents, including video data that they had been holding that the public hasn't seen. And the people that sued them are right now releasing some of that video. And one of the videos they released just today is of Michael Hess, the city's corporation counsel, on the 8th floor of World Trade Center Building 7, prior to it collapsing, begging for someone to come and rescue him. And if you watch the video, you'll notice that the building is not scooped out, as NIST would like to have you believe.
Right.
And, you know, this is still in the urgent times when Mr. Hess is trying to save his life. So he hasn't recanted on the BBC years later that explosions occurred within that building.
That's tremendous. I saw that video this morning, and it brought back a lot of old points that I remembered from years prior. I'm really excited about some of the new stuff that's coming out. It just kind of seems like it's getting to the point of saturation where, I mean, how much more evidence do we need to be able to wake up the general public?
Well, I have to agree with you. You know, everything has to be presented in a manner which is consumable by somebody who may be skeptical of this information or may not want to keep it all. And, you know, having somebody come out just about 3 or 4 months ago who worked for Controlled Demolition Incorporated for almost 20 years with the Lazo family saying there is no doubt that World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 were controlled demolitions should have been front page headlines across the world. Yet it was buried in the alternative media and never even given one serious note by the supposed mainstream authority out there.
Jason, this is Ken McDermott Rowe. Hi, thanks for being on. Many of our listeners don't have an in-depth knowledge of 9/11. What would you say to a listener who said, how could this happen? So many people must have been involved. How could they keep such an event a secret?
Well, a lot of people have to realize this isn't an event where a bunch of people get into a room and they say, this is what we're going to do, and all of us have these little parts. No, it's through compartmentalization and war gaming and red and blue teams that they were actually able to carry out 9/11. Let's take a look at the hijackers, for instance. Now, 17 of the 19 hijackers came into this country through a Saudi Arabian consulate that was a CIA front base. So let's just start right there. These 17 individuals, many of them probably worked with Western intelligence and were told that they were going to be trained in the United States at military facilities. And then they were. The mainstream media reported this. Now, this doesn't mean that the U.S. military is training them to carry out 9/11. No, it's teaching them how to work within teams, teaching them compartmentalization. It's teaching them military skills. So that's why you have some of the hijackers training at Maxwell Air Force Base, at Brooks Air Force Base, at the Defense Language School in California, and the Pensacola Navy Station in Florida. That's right. How that works. Then you have the hijackers work on wargaming, hijacking planes in the months before 9/11. So again, these people think that they're taking part in war games. Well, Jason, how do you know this? We had actor James Woods go public and say that in the summer before 9/11, he took a flight with Otta and three of the other hijackers that supposedly didn't even know each other. You see, these people were supposed to be in separate cells, but obviously they weren't. And James Woods was so concerned that they were going to hijack the plane that he took a stewardess by the side, said, I think these guys are going to hijack the plane. He said, I think so too. Took him into the cockpit where the pilot said the same thing. All three of them filed reports as well as the FAA, and they all walked. Well, obviously, even in a post or a pre-9/11 world, those people would have been picked up by the FBI and the CIA immediately unless they had military clearances. Then you take a look at some of the drills that were actually running on 9/11. And again, a lot of people that were running these drills are good military people, had no idea what was going on. We later found out by listening to the NORAD tapes that many of these military exercises were taking place underground in bunkers at Cheyenne Mountain and taking place throughout the day on 9/11. They did not stop till 20 minutes after United 93 supposedly came down.
How would these exercises, Jason, have played into the plan then to commit the 9/11 terror attack?
Sure. So if you're running hijacking exercises in NORAD, you're putting false blips on the screens of everybody else in the country. That's why, and most people don't realize this, the four planes on 9/11 that supposedly were used didn't emit hijack signals, but other planes did. We had hijackings coming out of Alaska. We had hijackings coming out of Canada. We had a bomb threat on Delta 1989, which coincided with United 93's flight pattern. So there are all these ghost attacks as the real ones are taking place.
So these are in fact exercises.
Yes, they are in fact exercises. There's absolutely no doubt. When you listen to the NORAD tapes, and we were the first ones to get them outside of government officials, we immediately posted them on the web. They have multiple channels, and you can listen into them. And NORAD is furious in the northeastern sector as these blips, these radar blips, are not taken off. In fact, we have multiple confirmations of this within the 9/11 Commission hearings themselves. In Fabled Enemies, and I believe Loose Change Final Cut, we show you multiple instances where people like Richard Myers, who were the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, talking about these exercises and these drills. One of the least lesser-known drills also going on that day, which is still heavily classified, and I encourage anybody out there listening to go look into it, is Operation Jackal Cave that was taking place on 9/11. What do we know about this exercise? Well, it's Muslim terrorists in Afghanistan carrying out a terrorist attack in the United States. Other than that, we don't know anything. Everything else is blacked out.
Excuse me, I can interrupt you. Just 1 second, Jason. We've been focusing this evening on the controlled demolition, and I know you've done a lot of research on Osama bin Laden. Could you talk about the logistical possibility that he could have pulled off the destruction of the World Trade Center? And if you didn't think he did it, what would have been the logistical problems?
Specifically the controlled demolition. Could the Al-Qaeda Muslims have been able to pull off a controlled demolition?
Absolutely not.
I don't know you're going to say that.
what would be the problems that they would face?
Well, here's the deal. If there were bombs in the building, which we know from the physical evidence, from the video evidence, from the eyewitness testimony, we now know without any shred of doubt that there were explosives in 1, 2, and 7. I'm sorry, folks. Do the research for yourself, and you will find that there is no other answer. If that were the case, first of all, you would take those four planes and you would ram them into separate targets. Why run them into the World Trade Center? Why would you ever give people a chance to get out of a building in a terrorist attack? Those buildings held well over 50,000 people when at maximum capacity. They were a city within a city. If you were Muslim terrorists who planted bombs in those three buildings, you would have brought them down in the middle of Manhattan, easily killing 50,000 to 100,000 people with the surrounding area, and you would have had a maximum casualty.
So basically, you're saying it just doesn't make logistical sense. If you went to the trouble to hijack multiple airplanes to hit them into the same buildings that you already planted bombs in.
Yeah, there is no way that they would do that. And if you look at the flights themselves, this is something that is often overlooked by just about every researcher out there. The four flights they supposedly used, when you combine the maximum occupancy, and you see how many people were on them combined, it is less than 20%. When you are in a jumbo jet that carries over 200 people, they do not let them take off when they are at under 20%. I believe some of them were at, one was like at 12, one was at 15, and the other two rounded out at about 30%. None of them were even close to halfway full. How would the terrorists know to take early morning flight on a Tuesday? I've flown all over the country, back and forth, and I have never, never been on a large commercial flight that is, I mean, three-quarters full maybe. Right. Maybe once in a while I'll have that, but never at a quarter capacity. And somehow these Muslim terrorists chose the path of least resistance with their box cutters and found planes that weren't booked.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us. We're running out of time. I just want to ask you really quick, do you have any future films coming out or plans for the radio show, Info Warrior?
Absolutely, guys. I am working hard right now to get this next film project underway. I actually have a meeting about it tomorrow.
That's great.
As soon as I know more about it, I will let people know. And yes, I am also itching to come back to the radio and, YouTube and all the video streaming, but it has to be profitable. I mean, you know, I'm now in my 30s. I'm taking care of myself, and I just can't spend, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week doing something. And then the preparation on top of it, that I can't pay the bills with. So,
right.
If there's a demand out there, if there's someone out there that wants to help me out, get a hold of me. I'm very easy to get a hold of. Facebook.com/TheInfoWarrior/JasonBermis. Go check out my films for free online, Fabled Enemies, Invisible Empire, and do the research yourself.
Thanks, Jason,
for joining us. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we're streaming at WPKN.org. And we've been talking about the possibility that the World Trade Center was brought down in a controlled demolition using explosives placed inside the buildings. And we're taking calls. We're at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And we're taking your calls, and we'd like to hear what you think about this theory and about the collapse of the World Trade Center.
So we've got a couple other shows that'll be coming up, and we're going to be talking the same topic, but with a much deeper coverage, more angles, not just the internal demolition, the controlled demolition.
Well, I believe we have a call.
Yeah, another call. Go ahead. Bring him up.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Fantastic show.
Thank you.
Is there any truth that George Bush's brother was a majority owner in the security company that handles security in the Trade Center and also at Logan?
I believe that he was on the board of Securicom, Marvin Bush, at the time in the months prior to the attack, and I believe that's significant because if there was a placement of superthermite bombs or incendiary inside the building, the people who did it would have taken quite a bit of time to do so. They would have been had tremendous expertise. And one of the possibilities is that they used an elevator repair project as a cover for doing that.
As a cover. Yeah. Hey, you guys are doing a fantastic job.
Thanks very much, caller.
Thank God for you guys.
All right, thanks.
Bye bye.
Go ahead,
caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I've got a question or a comment about your physics.
Okay, go ahead.
Sure.
Earlier, I was driving in the car and couldn't talk to you, but somebody said that there was the steel in that building had to get up to 2,700 degrees to melt.
For the melting point.
Yeah, 2,750.
That's not the point where it bends.
Really though. Not necessary. A steel turns red hot at 800 degrees
right.
and has lost all its strength.
That's
and therefore
fine.
It couldn't support all the concrete and the rest of the mass above the fire.
And that's a fine point, but that doesn't answer A, how was the molten steel leaking out of the corners, and B, the white smoke that was coming off of that as well. Obviously, the heat was much higher at those points. And B, why didn't the top just tip because it was asymmetrical damage? Why didn't it just tip toward the hole and fall off or bend? The collapse never arrested at any point.
Well, you don't know if it was asymmetrical or not, because the planes
I do know
right
it was asymmetrical.
The building.
Clearly, the damage to both buildings, both the towers, was asymmetrical, and the fires were local. So it would be inconsistent with this kind of symmetrical collapse. But that's a very good point about the weakening of the steel. We have another caller.
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Hi.
Hi. I'm just calling. I just want to just put a little piece of information in their report that I read.
Go ahead, let's hear it.
After the 9/11 thing about the structure.
Uh-huh.
It was in a magazine called Paranoid Magazine.
That's a nice title.
And it was a report of a person who was on the design team for the Trade Centers back in the early 60s, like 1963. And this person has suggested things like, ways to get people out of the buildings if there were a fire, harmonic dampeners so that the buildings would have a little more structural integrity. And I think that the thing, thermite and the internal explosions, I think it's a ruse because the person who was on the design team suggested that the buildings were intentionally built so that they would collapse in a fire. Just a couple examples of fires that have collapsed buildings. The Cincinnati Stock Exchange was one of the first steel frame buildings, like back in 1880, right?
Okay.
And that was all clad with hardwood interior. When that thing burned, boy, this huge five-story building at the time, steel frame, collapsed completely into its foundation, which a wooden building wouldn't do. Part of the century, they had huge oil derricks, like 700 feet tall, made out of steel. When they would have a blowout from a well and it would catch fire, you'd see these huge steel structures come crumbling down, just dramatically, completely disintegrating. And this is like 1900,
Well, I mean, that's a long time ago of difference between
1963. They knew how to build a building that would collapse on itself. And you notice none of the trusses went completely across. They all went to the center where the elevator shaft.
Well, they did crisscross in a point so that it wouldn't just collapse like that. I mean, the designer described the building as poking a pencil through a windscreen screen door if a plane
well,
was
check
to...
Check out this article in Paranoid magazine. Somebody who knows, it's called Paranoid.
Okay. Thank you for the
Paranoid
call.
Paranoid magazine, and the designer suggests that these buildings were designed to be collapsed in this dramatic fashion. No thermites necessary, just the oil from the planes.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
I think the main difference there is that, I mean, the two examples that he cited, one, they basically had tinder built in. One was a wood floors, and I mean today the World Trade Center was 5 inches of concrete with steel pans interwoven into all the floors. And you know, I just don't see that there's really a comparison there. I'm not sure. I mean, I think that a magazine named Paranoid Magazine has kind of discredit itself at the point.
Well, I think we'll talk a moment for about John Skilling, who was the head structural engineer for the World Trade.
Skilling, right?
In the 1960s, and in a 1993 interview, Skilling stated that the towers were designed to withstand the impact and fires resulting from the collision of a large jet liner such as a Boeing 707 or a DC-8. And that it would not affect the building's structural integrity.
And a 707 is a four-engine plane that flew at expected 100 miles an hour faster than the 757 Boeing that struck the World Trade Center.
That's a 767,
Is a two-engine plane and was cruising at, I think, what, 485 miles an hour?
And if you, I'm not sure, I don't know offhand what the speed was, but if you compare the two planes, then the modern one, the 767, is 20% heavier, but it goes about 20% slower.
Right.
And it wasn't fully loaded. It had less than half its fuel, less than half its passengers.
As Jason Burmes pointed out a few minutes ago.
So likely it actually hit the building with less energy than a fully loaded 707. And then you also have the statement by Frank DeMartini, who was the on-site construction manager, who on a TV interview in January 25th, 2001, which you can see if you go to our blog, incontextreport.com. Gus and I have articles on the World Trade Center, and in one of the articles you will find links to some of the important evidence regarding it. And Frank DeMartini has an interview in January 25th, 2001, where he was asked what would happen if a plane hits the World Trade Center, and he said it will not hurt the building significantly. He said, in fact, you could probably have multiple impacts, and he has, as you mentioned earlier, it was like a screen door. It was like putting a pencil through a screen door wouldn't affect the integrity of the screen.
Right.
And unfortunately, Frank DeMartini died in the 9/11.
That's right. Another call? All right, bring it up.
Good evening, caller.
Hi. I talked to you earlier on. I wanted to call back about something. Some gentleman called in there and doesn't kind of believe that the steel melted, you know, the way steel will melt so fast. He thinks 800 degrees, the whole tower is going to collapse. It doesn't. The entire structure would not have got equally hot. Steel wicks away the heat.
That's a very good point. It wicks away the heat. There are things called heat sinks. What's a heat sink? Is that something?
It's a bearing between a level of insulation between the joints where the heat will have a chance to be absorbed and dissipate so that it doesn't transfer from one truss to the other.
Heat dissipates, fires go up, they go down.
Right.
It's not as if it was subjected to some giant...
It was a multi-floor fire, but there have been multi-floor fires in that building before. I think in 1976 there was a fire that started in electrical closet or something like that, and it went over 11 floors and burned for, I think, like 12 or 14 hours, and it was a three-alarm fire that took hundreds of firemen to put out, and it didn't cause any lasting damage.
Right, and there's another thing. I have a quick audio clip, if I could play it here. It's from the mainstream media talking about explosions. I'll just play it really quick.
Okay,
give it a shot.
We've heard reports of secondary explosions after the aircraft impacted, whether in fact there wasn't something else at the base of the tower that in fact were the coup de grace to bring them to the ground.
When you're down there, Dan, you hear smaller secondary explosions going off every 15 or 20 minutes. And so it is an extremely dangerous place to be.
I mean, those are just some examples.
That's right.
Very good. Yeah.
Yeah, there are dozens of examples out there, and we're going to be playing some of those clips on Sunday the 5th and on Saturday the 11th. We're going to be on the air on September 11th, Saturday morning from 6 to 9 a.m., and we are going to be bringing a lot of audio clips, just like the ones that the caller just brought up.
Yeah, because when people hear the mainstream media on that day, there was a lot of footage, but they only played it once, and once only. If you weren't home during the time, they scrubbed it.
A lot of those interviews are lost to the memory hole, just because they just grab someone random on the street and they would put them out over the air. But a week later, a month later, when the final official story compilation of all the great news clips that were done, those weren't in there.
That's correct.
Well, thank you very much
for
calling
back
and adding more to the show.
Okay.
Ken, you did mention the website before, and I just want to note that we are going to be podcasting all of our shows, all of our in-context shows, and you can subscribe to that podcast to be automatically downloaded into your iTunes client or whatever other MP3 clients you have, and all that information is on the website, and it's incontextreport.com.
That's right, guys.
And you can sign up to be alerted whenever there's a show update and a new article posted, and... thanks. That's another edition of In Context.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
And glad everybody participated in the show tonight. And tune back in on the 5th and the 11th.
That's Sunday night. This Sunday night from 10 to 11. And again on Saturday, September 11th from 6 to 9 o'clock in the morning for your early birds. And we'll take calls and visit us online at incontextreport.com. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. Thanks for joining us, and please stay tuned for Chris Teske, who is coming up next. Your little protest, so merrily rejected. It was an inside job, like it always is. Chalk it up to business as usual.